Okay, well, hey, welcome. It's a nice little group. We're going to have fun tonight. We're going to do a flyover of church history. And this, I'm a history buff. So this stuff totally fascinates me. So hopefully it will fascinate you too. But we will be trying to show the intersection between the Bible and history and going, you know, trying to make this point that the Bible shaped history, but that history also shaped the Bible. And so it's really an interesting story. So ask lots of questions, and we'll see how much we can flesh out. This also, this is session 7, I believe, and will be the last session of our introductory material. After this, we're actually going to get into the nuts and bolts and start mirroring some of the material. Actually, tonight, if we get far enough, we'll be mirroring some of the, or talking about some of the material on page 28 of your texts, dealing with a special and general revelation. But we'll see if we actually get that far. We're just about done with the intro. Yeah, isn't that exciting?
We should summarize.
Last week, we talked about the temple state, the Greek polis, the city-state, and then we talked about the Roman Republic as being within the Mediterranean world, the three primary forms of government that mankind had established to that point. And the temple state.
Temple state,
which is the the form of government that was used by virtually all of the Middle Eastern Mesopotamian civilizations. No, it had to do with that the government was built on two pillars, the king and the high priest. The king was the highest in power, but the lowest in purity. The high priest was the highest in purity, but the lowest in power. It was honed over thousands of years. It was an absolutely ingenious division of labor and authority and power, so that everybody within that government had a place and knew exactly what that place was. Incredibly stable governments that lasted for thousands of years. But the whole idea was that the king was a sovereign. He was the one who could get things done, either in terms of public works, law, courts. So he was a judge, jury, and executioner. He was warrior, and he was head builder, all in one. And he could do whatever he wanted within that context. And the high priest was the one who kept harmony and order, and created a sense of binding together and national pride through the temple system. When someone went outside the law, the temple system, the sacrificial system, was the means by which they could be brought back in again. They were in charge of creating festivals and pageantry and giving the people a national identity, you know, based in their God and based in their king. And then finally, they were the ones who dispersed human services. So tithes would come in, and then they would disperse them to people who needed it, you know, through the what would, you know, be their welfare system. And so between those two, there was then the scribes, who were the professional lawyers and the writers of the law, and those three created the system that we're familiar with in Judaism at the time of Jesus. But since, you know, at least for 3,000 or 4,000 BCE, the temple state had been in place throughout the Sumerians, the Chaldeans, the Akkadians, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, and the Hebrews, the Egyptians. All of these were temple states, very, very stable forms of government. Alexander the Great comes on the scene around 330 BCE and effectively wipes out all of the city-states and replaces them with the Greek city-state, but in a sort of bastardized form. The Greek city-state that started around 900 BCE were small city-sized governments that were based in the wealthy landowners having a say over their own affairs. So there was no king. There was no representation. It's the wealthy landowners themselves deciding what happened within their borders. Alexander used that as a mark of imperial power to build a Greek polis right next to an existing city, which would suck the life out of the city and transform that culture into a Hellenized culture, a Western Greek culture. But by 63, Rome had supplanted the Greeks now with what until 44 thereabouts BCE was the Roman Republic. So the Roman Republic had stood for about 500 years in Italy and had been exported throughout as they were building their empire. But right after Julius Caesar is assassinated, you know, Augustus comes on and establishes himself as the first emperor. And so now in 300 years, you had the collapse of all three of those systems of government: the temple state, the Greek polis, and the Roman Republic. And all that's left standing now is Roman Empire for another 500 years till it collapsed in the West around 476. So this created this incredible soup within especially the Eastern Mediterranean, where people were just kind of rudderless. You know, they really didn't have a sense of place. Their cultures had been ripped up. Their sense of government had been ripped up. And so they were really looking for something that made sense. You know, their world was upside down. And where were the gods in all of this from a pagan point of view? And from a Jewish point of view, where was Yahweh in all of this? And where were the promises that had been passed down from Abraham for thousands of years? How could this be? And so you see in those last couple of centuries leading up to Jesus coming on the scene, a rising national, you know, fervor for the Messiah, the Mashiach, who would come back and would reestablish the promise that God had made to Abraham. And so this is all coming to this crisis point. As Jesus is preaching in the early first century, all of these forces, especially in Judea, are just colliding. And now you have the Zealots coming on the scene in the first century BCE, and they're the terrorists of their day. They were the ones who were trying to destabilize the Roman regime in Judea. They were assassinating Roman legionnaires, soldiers, government officials. They were causing riots. They were doing anything that they could to destabilize the area. And in you know, looking forward to this coming war when the Messiah would reveal himself and lead them to victory. And only 30 years after the crucifixion, they succeeded in igniting the war, but didn't do them any good because the Romans put it down in no uncertain terms and destroyed the temple and most of Jerusalem in 70 CE. And then that peace, such as it was, only lasted another 30 years, actually about 60 years. In 132, a second Jewish-Roman war broke out, and that Emperor Hadrian put down with such force that he basically razed Jerusalem to the ground, sold salt into the earth, forbade Jews to even be seen in Judea on pain of death, and there was no discernible Jewish state in Palestine. He even changed the name from Judea to Palestine. And he did that also, Palestine coming from the original Philistines who lived in the land. So it was a slap in the face to rename it Palestine in the first place. But Hadrian did that in around 132, and the Jews had no homeland until 1948. So that's kind of the what's going on as we're now set to jump into this timeline here, which begins with Jesus. So Jesus is on the scene in this, you know, rising tension, this kind of cauldron that's ready to boil over in Judea in the early part of the first century. And he comes on the scene, and he is looked at by his followers because everybody is aware of the Messiah, the coming of the Messiah. Everybody's looking for the Messiah, you know, and every one of the major four groups within Judaism, Sadducees, Pharisees, Essenes, and the Zealots had different ways of looking for how this promise was supposed to be fulfilled, because they knew from Abraham that the promise was supposed to be fulfilled, that they were supposed to be a light among the nations, and their descendants were going to be as numerous as the stars and the sand on the beach. And so there were all of these itinerant sages and preachers, you know, in the model of Jesus, roaming the countryside and proclaiming, you know, the coming of God's kingdom and all of this sort of thing. But who are you supposed to look at? Who are you supposed to follow? And of course, the Essenes are looking in a militaristic way. They want someone who is going to, you know, commit sedition and really start to ramp up the opposition. And so as Jesus comes on the scene, as his fame grows, as his prowess grows, you know, in terms of his healing and some of the miracles that are attributed to him and all, you know, they're looking more and more intently at him. And then when he comes back to Jerusalem and all this kind of, you know, hits the boiling point. The interesting thing about Jesus is that whenever someone was trying to put the mantle of power on him, he would push it away. He would not go there. And it's very clear that what he was trying to do was trying to establish that his kingdom was not of this world. He wasn't trying to do what the popular conception of Messiah was supposed to do. He wasn't there to do that. His message was a micro message. And if you analyze the red letters in the Gospels of what Jesus said, everything was geared toward one-on-one relationships. And there's nothing clearer than that than Matthew 5, the first chapter of the Sermon on the Mount, where he goes through the antitheses, where he says, you've heard it of old said that, but I tell you, you know, you've heard it of old said that, you know, if you murder someone, then you'll be guilty under the law. But I'm telling you that if you're just angry, you're already guilty. And he goes through these things, and he's taking the context from the group, from the micro, from the law, and trying to reframe it into individual relationships. Very different thing. He doesn't have a developed theology. He's not, I mean, read through those red letters again. Where is there really a theology that Jesus is establishing? There isn't one. Paul has a theology. Very well developed theology, you know, and he's writing 15 to 20 years later. But Jesus doesn't give us a theology. He said, I haven't come to abolish what you already have. I'm not here to abolish the law. I'm here to fulfill it. He was working within Judaism to purify it, to bring it back to its roots, to remove the blockages that the Pharisees especially had put between the people and their God. But he wasn't really developing a new theology. Where after the crucifixion, this leads to a lot of confusion. Because if there is no real developed theology, if there's no clear roadmap that Jesus left, if he really wasn't so much trying to build a new church, how do you follow in that tradition? If everything is micro, if it's one-on-one, if he's trying to find ways to turn people's heart lights on so that they can relate to each other in this way that he called kingdom, how do you hang a church on that? What do you do with it? And the answer is, you don't. You know, it was so hard for followers of Jesus after the crucifixion to just be able to follow in his footsteps in any sort of organized way. And that was the problem. How do you organize around these principles? They're a way of life, but to organize was very difficult. And I believe that's why we see such a radical difference between the style of Jesus and the style of Paul. Paul comes on the scene, and he's trying to do everything that Jesus wasn't trying to do out of necessity. He had to code shift from the micro, from individual one-on-one relationships, to now dealing with groups and churches all throughout the Eastern Mediterranean. And often he's doing it by remote control, because he's on a missionary journey going around, and he's sending letters back, or he's sending surrogates back to talk to the people. So he's doing it by remote control, but he's dealing with groups of people. So he's shifting Jesus' message from the micro to the macro. He's also shifting Jesus' message from east to west, because he's primarily working in Greek areas and then in Roman areas. And so he's moving from east to west. And he's basically applying the message of Jesus, but in a new context. And so he has to deal with things very differently. And so there's a real radical shift. People have often attributed that to Paul basically starting his own religion. And you may have heard that criticism before, that Paul was a synthesis of Jesus' teaching and existing pagan religions, you know, in Hellenized Greek areas. I don't think we need to go there, because I think just by nature of Paul trying to apply what was essentially an Eastern micro message into a Western macro setting, you can see where he had to go with all of that. So now that we've made this code shift and we're working in Greek areas as well as Jewish areas, the original followers of Jesus who were Jews are now being asked to accommodate the whole Gentile world. And how does that really happen? major centers, or I should say, in any of the cities where the followers of Jesus were taking hold, what was really going on within that soup that we were talking about is people trying to find ways to relate to each other. And so these new groups, these new communities would spring up in people's homes. And if you read the book of Acts, that's where you're going to see this most clearly laid out. People meeting usually in wealthy women's homes, it seems like. You see the names like Lucilla and some of these others that were hosting these meetings. And it was basically voluntary communism. People would come and they would bring all of their increase during the week. They'd lay it on the table. They'd divvy it up, making sure that widows and orphans had got what they needed. They'd have a common meal. They'd sing songs and they would pray together. And if Paul or one of the itinerant preachers was in the area, they would speak to them. And if they weren't and they got a letter, they would read the letter aloud. And these were their worship services. But basically what they were there for was to make sure that everybody's life and everybody's boat floated as high as it could. And the byproduct of that was that they also worshiped together and sang songs and bolstered each other's faith. But again, it was a way of life. And so when people talk about the early church, I think that's the way we need to see the church. It was primarily a community that helped each person within the community have the best life that they could possibly have. And the worship forms grew out of that, rather than the other way around. Our churches kind of flipped that over. Now our churches are all about Sunday morning, where we get together for an hour and a half, and then we turn around and try to find ways to fit into the community. But the early church was the exact opposite. The worship was more or less a byproduct of their deep desire to make sure that everybody had what they needed, to practice love in that way, which was, as James said, you know, what good does it do to be, say, be warm and be filled if you don't do anything to feed and clothe somebody? You know, do that first, and then everything else becomes possible. And you see the early church doing that, just that very thing. And that's, to me, what's beautiful about it. And so in these cities where these communities are growing up, and you can imagine in that crazy society where everything is so fluid, this stuff really took hold. This was attractive. This was recreating community and stability and the kind of thing that people remembered, you know, from their fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers that existed before in these thousands of year old stable governments that was now so fluid. And so it starts to spread like wildfire throughout the Eastern Mediterranean. In the cities that were larger, the communities grew larger as well. And so five major centers of Christianity, what would eventually be called Christianity, started to develop within the Mediterranean basin. And they were Rome and what eventually became Constantinople but was originally Byzantium, Antioch, which is in present-day Lebanon, that area right there, Jerusalem, of course, and Alexandria in Egypt. Those were the five major centers. And they were major because the cities were major. They were the major cities of commerce, and so they had the largest populations. They all spoke Greek as well as their basic languages, their indigenous languages. But those were the five major centers of Christianity. Eventually, as these populations grew, it obviously became necessary for there to be an overseer, someone who looked after all of these various home groups and home communities and tried to bring them together and to oversee. And that word overseer in Greek is episkopos, and it's the word that we get our word bishop from. So eventually these bishops, these overseers, started to be put in place, and they came out of the community, someone who was very learned and someone who the people respected and could gain that kind of respect from the people, became overseers in these various areas. Well, there were lots of overseers. At the time of the Council of Nicaea in 325, when Constantine calls the first ecumenical council, he sent out about 1,800 invitations to all the known bishops throughout the Roman Empire at the time. And so there were lots of them, you know, 300 years later. And so at this time, they're still growing. But these bishops, these overseers in those major centers had much more influence, of course, than bishops from small cities. And the major city, of course, in the empire was at Rome. And so the bishop of Rome at least in his own mind, he was a legend in his own mind, he saw himself as having preeminence over all the other bishops and tried to exert that influence. And so this is the beginning of our concept of a pope. But there was no pope. In fact, pope comes from the Greek papas, which simply means father. And so any of these bishops were called pope, were called papas in that respect, because they were seen as the father of their community. What I wanted to try to impress upon you was that the early church was very unlike the way we think of the Catholic Church. We think of the Catholic Church as being the progenitor of the early church, but it had nothing to do with that in terms of a real hierarchical power. It was like the Wild West. It was real wild and woolly. And the notion that the early church was unified in one accord, because we get that phrase from the book of Acts, nothing could be further from the truth. Jesus didn't give us enough to go on to unify us under any one banner. And Paul did, and that's why most of church authority is built on Paul's writings and not on Jesus' teachings. But there was so much diversity, it was a virtual explosion. I mean, every one of these communities had the opportunity to basically teach whatever they wanted to teach. You know, that the apostles, the ones that were going out under that sort of authority, they were the ones who were trying to rein it in and try. And so you see Paul fighting against all these other groups. If you read his letters, you know, most of the letters were written in opposition to something that was going on that he knew was wrong or thought was wrong. And so that's what the letters were all about. But the diversity was incredible. And so you have the Gnostics, and you have Manichaeans, and you have Valentinians, and you have all these other groups that are mentioned, but you got a heck of a lot more than that. And then you've got our what are called our early church fathers. And these are people like Tertullian and eventually Augustine and some of these others, Irenaeus, who are typically, they were bishops in some of the major centers, but sometimes they were just influential teachers and thinkers and writers who were also writing at the same time. And they're taking all this in, and they're writing against what they saw as heresies. But remember, at this time, there's no canon. There's no Bible, per se. You know, there's no New Testament. There is no set doctrine. You know, there's no... There's no orthodox anything at this point. And so you've just got all these people running around saying they're following Jesus, and they're all following him in their own way. So it's a real crazy time. But it's an exciting time. And the fervor is just palpable in these people as they're trying to follow Jesus. Yeah.
Would you say that for Israel, becoming a nation, what kind of government?
Before Israel became a nation?
Before Israel became a nation, how were they being led? How were they, you know...
Are you talking before a temple state was developed in Israel?
Well, was Israel a temple state before they became a nation? In other words, how did they run the government before they became a nation?
If you go back before David and before Saul, David is credited with unifying all the tribes. Before that, the tribes operated within governments of their own. Each tribe operated independently of the others. And you had what were called judges, if you go back to the book of Judges. And so if there was some national calamity, something that required the tribes to work in concert with each other, somebody would be chosen out of obscurity. Someone like a Samson, someone like a Gideon, someone like a Deborah. Got a woman in there. Good. You know? Who would be called out of obscurity, out of whatever they did day to day, who would then be the one who could galvanize, raise an army, you know, store grain, do whatever they needed to do. And then when the crisis was passed and everything was met, they would go back into obscurity. But the judges were temporary rulers that would come to the fore. So that was the type of government they had. It was as close as you can probably come to a pure theocracy, where the tribes were basically living according to the law of Moses and their own system of adjudicating that law within their own tribe, and then getting together under the leadership of a judge when some sort of national interest was at stake. But eventually the tribes decided that they really wanted a king, and even though it was against God's better judgment at the time. And Samuel was trying to tell them this, you know, and they got the king that they sort of deserved in Saul. But in David, they had a true benevolent king who was able to unify the tribes, create a monarchy, and that began the Davidic line of kings that ran until they were overrun by the Assyrians and the Babylonians, you know. But that's what they had before. They had a kingdom. There was nothing. No. What you have after the temple is destroyed in 70 AD is you have the surviving group. There was the four groups I told you about. Only one survives the first Jewish-Roman war, and that's the Pharisees. And they reconvene in a coastal town called Yavne, and they reinvented Judaism. They took it from being a temple-based system to being a synagogue and home-based system. And they redefined the sacrificial system. And instead of being sacrifices, they now were good deeds, mitzvah. And so they reorganized and just reset the entire religion. And that was able to survive for 2,000 years and is surviving to this day. But it was that synagogue-based system that allowed them to, and their strict adherence to the law and to their culture and way of life, that allowed them to survive as an identifiable group, you know, up until the present day.
So the Davidic kingdom is still alive, even though it's not a kingdom per se. There's a king that is the leader of that.
No. No, the Davidic line ended, and there is no kingdom, and there is no temple. They don't have any of that. That's all gone. They're still looking forward to it being reestablished someday. Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's going to be rebuilt. They've been talking about it for 35 years.
Yeah.
So Jesus is the perpetual king.
Did you turn on the air, baby? It might not be a bad idea. Okay, so you got, as we're looking at this outline here, you've got Jesus transmitting his message to the apostles and the other disciples, who are transmitting the message now to these believer communities that were originally called koinonia, which means a fellowship, or ecclesia, which means a gathering. And these are the ones that we're talking about. The main five one there being Jerusalem, Antioch, Rome, Alexandria, and Byzantium. But the other ones that you're familiar with, Corinth, Ephesus, Philippi, Thessalonica, Philadelphia, Laodicea, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Smyrna, all of these either that were letters that were written to the various groups, or some of the churches that are mentioned in the book of Revelation. These are all the early communities, but they were cities around the Greek world. And these were these early gatherings, these ecclesia. And oh, I'm sorry. No, it's right there. These are these early churches, as we would say churches, but were really just understood as gatherings. The overseers that are all equal are being established as we go forward. And then, you know, eventually we see this growing prominence of Rome, or the idea that the bishop of Rome, even though, you know, ecclesiastically he's equal with anybody else, but he starts to gain prominence. The tradition of Peter and Paul both going to Rome, teaching in Rome, dying in Rome, being martyred in Rome, also starts to give more prominence to the Bishop of Rome. And of course, the Church, the Catholic Church today, recognizes Peter as being the first pope, you know, actually being established. But there's no real evidence that Peter was ever actually an episcopos, you know, a bishop of Rome, and tradition says that he went there and died there. But again, the evidence is lacking, so we don't really know. But this idea of Papas as father being restricted to the bishop of Rome, that didn't happen until 1073. So that's a full 1,000 years later before that term actually applies specifically to the bishop of Rome and nobody else could use it. So at 70, Jerusalem is destroyed. So the first of those five centers of Christianity is now gone. And this is what's important to see what starts to happen here. We have the five major centers, okay? Jerusalem and Antioch in Palestine. We have Alexandria in Egypt, Byzantium in Asia Minor, and then, of course, Rome. And now, as of 70 AD, Jerusalem is removed as a major Christian community. It's gone. Then, if you think about your world history, what happens in the 6th century is Muhammad and the rise of Islam in the Arabian Peninsula. And so by Muhammad's death in 632, I believe, CE, his generals and his followers now start expanding the empire. And they go eastward all the way to India, and they go westward across North Africa, and they go northward and eastward through the Middle East and into Palestine and north up into what is at that time the Byzantine Empire. And so by that 7th century or so, they have now overrun Alexandria and Antioch as well. And so now, by the time we get to that about the 7th century, there's only two major centers of Christianity left, and that's Rome and Byzantium. And I know I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but this is what starts to happen. This is why these centers of Christianity were obliterated so early on, and why the surviving manuscripts that we found in the last 150 years, primarily from dry climates, because those are the ones that could preserve the manuscripts the best, all come from certain traditions within Christianity. And the most interesting thing is since, for instance, Alexandria in Egypt ceased to be a thriving Christian community, at least in the open, after the 7th century, the manuscripts that we find there, that have been able to find there, are kind of like time capsules. They didn't keep growing throughout the last 1,500 years. They were frozen because they weren't allowed to be openly used and reproduced in that culture anymore. And so the ones that were squirreled away and stuck in clay jars and hidden in monasteries were frozen in time, and that is so valuable to us because we're seeing an earlier form of the manuscripts. They weren't continuously being recopied and going through all the changes throughout time that ones that were in continuing Christian communities and cultures were, for instance, in the Byzantine Empire, which lasted another 1,000 years after that. So it's really important to see how, as these Christian communities fell, how that was affecting the manuscripts and the writings that they were producing. So coming back in time a little bit, back to the 4th century, the other thing that we need to think about are the persecutions. And, of course, the persecutions against Christians are legend. But they really didn't occur the way we normally think of these persecutions. They weren't, especially early on, they weren't widespread and they weren't organized. They weren't system-wide throughout the Roman Empire. They're mostly sporadic. They were mostly like mob violence and riots that would occur in various areas. So some of them that are talked about in the book of Acts, the riot that Paul barely escapes from, I forget which city he was in when that happened. A lot of the persecutions were like that. As Christians were starting to have more impact on local cultures and local cities and changing the viewpoint of the people toward their gods, they were also killing off local trades. I mean, the artisan who makes all the little idols of all the little gods suddenly has no one to sell them to because they don't believe in those gods anymore, and he's not too happy about that. And the trade at the local temples and all the things that were going on that were supporting pagan religions as Christians are taking over. And so there's lots of tension in a lot of these communities. Nero is credited with having the first official persecution of Christians, especially after Rome burns, and this is in the 60s of the first century. But even so, these are sporadic and they're not really organized. But when you get into the middle of the 3rd century, around 250, the Emperor Decius starts the first real widespread, organized, and empire-wide persecutions of Christians. And when you get to Diocletian at the end of that same century, he comes on the scene around 280 or so. By this time, the Roman Empire is just about broke. they are on their last legs. And he goes through a series of reforms. He actually breaks the empire into four sections and puts a governor in charge. It was called the Tetrarchy, in charge of each of the four sections. And he's completely revamping new taxes. And it's kind of like what Obama's trying to do to the United States right now. Just revamping everything, you know, and trying to get some life back into empire. And one of the things that he does is he sees himself as the one who's going to restore Rome to its former glory, and that includes restoring it to its former theology and its former religious practices. So he and his cohorts initiate the most severe and long-lasting persecution of the Christians that lasts about 11 years, and it's a systematic attempt to completely wipe them out. And not only wipe them out, but wipe out all of their writings as well. They burn the books. They burn everything they can find. Christians have to sacrifice to the Roman gods, or it would be killed or exiled. Their lands would be seized. For 11 years, this goes on. And so many of the manuscripts that existed at that time are now destroyed. His successor is eventually, after a civil war, is Constantine. In the early 4th century. Constantine, we don't really know if he really was a Christian or not, but he credits the Christian God as putting him in as a sole emperor at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. And so he is a friend to Christianity at this time. And he and his cohorts in 313 right there, the Edict of Milan, is where a religious tolerance is granted throughout the empire. And so now Christians have a right to be. And he sees Christianity as a very important cog in being able to unify his empire, because it's fractured. He's just been through a civil war. So Christianity is a tool, at least, to be able to bring all this together. He doesn't make it a state religion, but he grants tolerance, but he starts to promote it as well. And the first thing that he needs to do is he needs to have books again. All the books have been burned. And so he commissions the writing and copying of books, but now they're going to be localized in the area of Byzantium. And so this has a huge impact, because as he starts recopying and redoing Bibles, they're all coming from a certain textual family. And by the time you fast forward to the time of the Protestant Reformation, the majority text, as it's called by then, all comes from this family that started at this time as Constantine tries to replenish, you know, stocks of the Bible. And so once again, history is shaping the Bible in terms of what we have received, because Diocletian wiped out the diversity of different textual families. And as Constantine restores it, he restores it in one area. And so that Eastern Bible, that Byzantium text, which is now called the Byzantine family, is one of the major surviving textual families. The other one is a Western text that was based in Rome. That was in Latin. The Byzantine text is in Greek. And then we finally find a third one just in the last 200 years in Alexandria. So we have an Alexandrian text. But these textual families are all being shaped by all of these things that are happening, you know, historically within the church. And so it's kind of fascinating how that also worked on. Constantine calls the first ecumenical council in 325. At this point, there still is no set canon, although most of the books of the Bible of the New Testament, as we recognize it, already are gathered into proto-canons, and several canons are floating around. It's not till 397 at the Council of Carthage that's finally finalized, and the canon is closed. And there was a few books that we've mentioned, Jude, 2nd, 3rd John, 2nd Peter, Revelation, that were the last ones to get in. They just really couldn't decide on those until the very end. But the Council of Nicaea begins the process of setting Orthodox everything. You know, they were the ones responsible for writing the Nicene Creed. They were the ones responsible for deciding certain diverse ideas, the Arian controversy being the main one. What was the nature of the Godhead? Was it one, or was it two? Was it three? What was it? You know, who was God? How did Jesus figure into this? How does the Spirit figure into this? So they started tackling those kind of questions, because Constantine, who chaired this whole council, by the way, was absolutely intent on getting order and getting unity because the church was tearing itself apart with these various controversies, and he needed the church to be unified so he could have it be a unifying force within empire. And so that council at Nicaea is the first attempt. There's a series of councils for the next several hundred years that are called the Council Age, where all of these things are being decided through these ecumenical councils of bishops. Basically, he sent out 1,800 invitations. About a third of those bishops actually came, but they all brought four or five people. So there was something like 1,800, you know, people at this council. 1,800 people of about somewhere around 300 or 400 bishops, and then their entourage. They could have 400 or 500 people, and Constantine paid the tab. He paid their travel expenses. He set them up in lodging. He paid for their food for the whole time that they were there. He needed these people there. He needed to gain credibility, and he needed to have the church become as unified as possible. But even so, what was decided at Nicaea didn't have an automatic effect throughout the churches in the empire. How could it? There was no force there. They couldn't force. And so all it did was set up the next 100 years controversy. So Nicaea decided what the nature of the Godhead was, but now how about the nature of Jesus? And so the Nestorian conflict and all the conflicts that followed throughout the 300s were trying to decide the nature of Jesus. Okay, now we've decided that he is God and he's made of the same substance as the Father, but then how is he still man? See, that's the next question. If he's God, is he man? Is he really man? Is he equally man and God? Is it mostly God with a little bit of man? Or is it mostly man with a little bit of God? I mean, these are all the things that they were trying to decide at the time. And in the Nicene controversy, there were two words that they were using in Greek. It was homoousios, which meant similar, and homoousios, which meant pretty much exactly the same. And the only difference between the two words is they are trying to decide, is Jesus the same substance or similar substance to the Father, was one Greek letter, which is our letter I, but in Greek is iota. And so the saying, does it make an iota of difference, comes from that controversy. Because they were fighting over these tiny, tiny little things that to us seem to make so little difference, but to them were of supreme importance as they were trying to decide, what is it we believe? What does it mean to be Christian? You know, and so the creeds and the basic doctrines come out of that.
Why didn't they just go with what Paul said?
Hmm?
Why didn't they just go with
Because Paul doesn't touch many of these issues. You won't find anything about the Trinity in Scripture.
He doesn't touch the concept that Jesus was God.
Yeah, but how is he God? But what does that mean? That's not specific enough for the lawyers among us. You know?
John said that.
No, I know exactly what you mean. But the point is, it's not specific enough. Because how is he God? Because here's the thing that was happening. In the Arian controversy, Arius was basically, he was what's termed a modalist. Because there's all different ways of looking at how the Son and the Father connect to each other or don't connect to each other. But Christianity comes out of Judaism, which was staunchly monotheistic. You did not do anything to mess with the Godhead in Judaism. It was one God. I mean, the Shema, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. This is the basic prayer that they prayed. So now they've understood Jesus as being one with the Father, but how was he one with the Father? And if he's one with the Father in any way God, then what does that do to God? And so Arius, who was a very strong monotheist, was saying that God the Father was one and that Jesus was subservient to the Father. And so there was a hierarchy there. And so now that's messing with Jesus' divinity. And so those who were really strong on Jesus' divinity are fighting with the Arians and calling them heretics. And so you see what I'm saying? It gets to the point where someone has to define what you mean if you say that Jesus was God or one with the Father. How? Is he exactly the same, homoousios, or is he similar, homoousios? And if he's similar, then what does that mean? The modalist said that God was one, but when he was dealing with creation, he was Father. When he was dealing with redemption, he was Son. And when he was dealing with sanctification, he was Spirit. And so he changed modes, but it was one God. The Gnostics were saying that Jesus was all God, and he only seemed to be man. And so he really didn't have a body like you and I. He only seemed to have a body because they considered matter to be evil and spirit to be good, and there was this dualism. And so they had their particular idea. You know, Nestorius had a completely different idea. He saw it as a prosopic union, where prosopon, which means hand or something in Greek. The best way to think of it is that just like a painter's brush is an extension of himself in his role as painter, you don't even see it as something outside of himself. It's an extension of who he is. That's his prosopon, you know, what he uses to be what he is. Jesus was God the Father's prosopon, his extension of himself in the area of redemption. There's Sabellianism. There's all these different ideas. There's adoptionism. You know, Jesus was adopted as God's son, but he didn't start out that way. And then the others say, no, he was that way from birth. And so that's what I'm talking about, the diversity here. You know, everybody trying to imagine, how does this happen? How does this work? And then everybody fighting, and then you've got Constantine trying to bring them all together.
Okay, so that what was that theory about the painter?
The prosopon?
Right, and so
well, that wouldn't have anything. See, this has to do with Jesus specifically as unique, because how was he God? If we understand him as God, how is he God? If God is one, because Christianity still is monotheistic, they say God is one, but what they came away with out of Nicaea was this sort of splitting of the hair, saying God is one, but he has three distinct persons within one God who are all of the same substance. Okay, and you can't understand it. It's a mystery how this works. And any analogy that you use, like water being, you know, frozen as ice and then liquid and then a gas, none of those really describe this, because it's that really what that describes more is modalism. You know, the same substance going in different and going through different modes at different temperatures. That would be more of a modalistic concept. But that's not what Nicaea came out with. They rejected modalism. And they said, no, there are three eternally coexisting persons who form one Godhead. And don't try to figure it out. It just is what it is. You know. And it really, you know, it made no one happy. But at least it was a decision. You know. And the interesting thing is that fast forward about 700 years, and now Roman and Constantinople, because Constantine moved his capital from Rome to Constantinople in 330, which then set up a real split within the Roman Empire, because now you've got two capitals, and he's taking up residence in the east, in Constantinople. And so by 1054, you've got the major church at Rome with the Bishop of Rome, and you got another major church at Constantinople with what was called the Patriarch of Constantinople, now totally fighting at each other with 700 years of bad blood, you know, behind them. Two different cultures, two different political systems. The Roman Empire has already fallen by this time in 476, and so politically Rome doesn't matter, but ecumenically it matters quite a bit. And so what Rome does is arbitrarily add one little phrase to the Nicene Creed, and it's called the Filioque clause. Filioque in Latin simply means "and the Son." So there, if you remember your Apostles' Creed, your Nicene Creed, there's a phrase that the Son proceeds from the Father. Remember that? I'm sorry, the Spirit proceeds from the Father. And that was the entire text from the Nicene Creed, that the Spirit proceeds from the Father. By adding Filioque, it now reads that the Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. And the Greeks, the Eastern Church, went absolutely nuts over that, because the Eastern Church is much more monotheistic and less Trinitarian theologically than the Roman Church was. And so where the Roman Church had no problem with the Spirit proceeding from both Father and Son, the Greeks had a huge problem with it. But even more so, the problem that they had was that Rome did it on their own without consulting them or bringing them into the debate at all. The other thing Rome was doing was forcing Greek churches in Italy, on the Italian peninsula, there's no Italy per se, to speak Latin. And so what the Greeks did was start forcing the Latin churches in Greek to speak Greek. And so, you know, it's just like tit for tat and these kids. So finally, Rome's had enough. They send an emissary to Michael Cerularius. This is Pope Leo IX sends this group over to Michael Cerularius in Constantinople, telling him he had to accept the Filioque Clause, he had to allow Latin churches to speak Latin, and he had to submit to the primacy of Rome as the bishop. And Michael Cerularius promptly excommunicated everyone in the group, and they excommunicated him. So everybody's excommunicating each other. But this is the beginning of the great East-West Schism in 1054, which is on your chart there. And the two churches have never been together since. So for the last 1,000 years, there's been an Eastern Orthodox branch and a Roman Catholic branch. But that's starting from all of this theological mess and these differences, these growing cultural and political differences, especially as Constantine separated the empire as he did, it was only a matter of time before the two split, and they finally do split in 1054. Monotheistic. Yeah. Yeah, it's not that they don't believe in the Trinity, but it's a much softer understanding. They would take the three persons and really, you know, see them more as one rather than separate. And they certainly wouldn't see the Spirit proceeding from the Son. Yeah. Yeah, it's more of you know, Father and then Son and Spirit kind of underneath the Father. It's more of a federal kind of thing where there's a headship and then there's more kind of subservience of Father and Son under the head, which is starting to approach what Arius originally, his original idea. Their theology leans more on that side of the scale. Remember, there's no hard and fast rules to any of this. There's just a scale from strict monotheism to strict polytheism. You know, everybody falls somewhere on that spectrum. You know, now what Nicaea tried to do was to create an arbitrary middle and saying, okay, we're monotheistic, but we got three personalities within that. And like I said, that didn't create a final answer. It just created a concept that the West rallied around. But the Eastern Orthodox were somewhere between that and strict monotheism. And so that was always an uneasy alliance between the two, and they finally end up splitting. So now we've got two histories, two threads that we've got to follow as we follow the history of the church, the East and the West. I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, Bill. I'm sorry, man.
It's got to be good.
There's this big thing, I didn't want to get too far down away from history, which we still is Constantine. There's this big thing about Constantine changed the doctrine of the church. And there's a lot of people say, no way Jose didn't happen. But as you relate this, it certainly seems like he could be a strong influencer.
Oh, he was absolutely was a strong influencer.
At a minimum. And I hear lots of experts mm-hmm. saying, no way, you know, he's arm's length at the closest.
He was not a scholar, and he was not learned in any of these areas. He let the bishops, you know, duke it out and do their thing. But you can bet that he had a lot of influence. And if nothing else, he's the one who forced the issue. He called them together, and he required them to take a stand and to make a decision. And, of course, it was a vote. It was majority rules, so there were people who left very unhappy from the council. But the interesting thing is that the successors of Constantine, they would go back and forth between an Arian type of concept and then back to an Orthodox concept, depending on what the emperor believed. So the emperor absolutely had influence over the church because whatever he believed became the prevailing belief within the church throughout the empire. And so it would flop back and forth as successive emperors would come to the throne. And so it was all throughout the 300s. It was pretty wild and woolly and things bouncing all over the place as successive emperors would come to power. And so, you know, to that extent, yeah, there was some influence being exerted from Rome. And then, of course, by the end of the century, when Christianity is finally and absolutely declared the state religion of Rome, and the pagan religions are outlawed, now everything changes, because all pagan temples are now turned into churches. All pagan priests have to convert, or they're exiled or killed, and their property is seized. Well, gee, that's tough, huh? Tough choice there. Well, I'm going to become Christian. So you just have this Christian veneer being dropped over the pagan system. You have Christian holidays simply being dropped over the existing pagan holidays that the people were already practicing anyway. So Christmas is dropped on the winter solstice and the Feast of Saturnalia, and Easter on the spring equinox and the Feast of Astarte. So you see this combining of pagan practice and rituals. Why do you think we have Christmas trees at Christmas time? Well, that goes all the way back to Babylonia and Tammuz and practices within Rome. Why do we have Easter eggs and bunnies at Easter? Has nothing to do with our tradition, but they were fertility rites because that's what the spring equinox was all about. And so eggs and bunnies are about fertility. So you see this combining of all of these customs and all of these practices being laid on top of one another. And, you know, people will convert when you put a knife to their throat. But really what was happening inside was a lot of the old practices were continuing to be practiced and revered, even though overtly they had to have some sort of Christian veneer. And so what comes out of this mix is a hybrid between the two. And so a lot of the practices, especially, you know, within Roman Catholicism, kind of mirror that time. But they also have been ported over into the Protestant branch of Christianity as well, because they're cultural at this point. They're deeply embedded into our psyche and our culture. What does any of this have to do with the teachings of Jesus? You know, that's kind of where we're coming to, is that by the second century, there is already such a strong split between Judaism and what eventually became Western Christianity that all concept of Jewish roots were gone. And they took it even a step farther. They began to understand Jews as the Christ killers, as the enemies of their faith. And so persecution now, which started with the Jews persecuting the Jewish followers of Jesus and Gentile followers of Jesus, now flips over. So it's Christians persecuting Jews, and that continues throughout all of the history of the church in various and horrible ways. The Spanish Inquisition was mainly aimed at Jews, and of course the Holocaust of World War II is you know, kind of the ultimate expression of this anti-Semitism.
So the Inquisition aimed at Jews?
Mm-hmm. Primarily. It came to encompass a lot of other things too, but in 1492 the Jews were expelled from Spain, and same year that Christopher Columbus sailed. But the Jews were disallowed from having any sort of function within the communities within Europe, and they fled to Morocco, they fled to Eastern Europe, they fled different places. But it's been a horrible, horrible history. And not in this class, but in the class where we're talking about the Jewish Jesus, we'll go into that history more fully to talk about, you know, why we are so firmly separated culturally from our Jewish roots. Honey?
It was not only a time when they were persecuting Jews, but they were forcing people to become Christian, right?
Mm-hmm. It was everybody, but it was really aimed at Jews originally. Absolutely, there's a whole group of people called Marranos. Have you ever heard of them in Spain? These are Marranos. These are Jews that nominally converted to Catholicism to save their skins and to save their lands, but they secretly continued to practice Judaism. And so there are Spanish Jews that are descended from Marranos and have Jewish blood in them, and they don't even necessarily know, because the Judaism was hidden away from the time of the Inquisition forward. And you have to do some pretty intense genealogical work to find out if you've got You know, it's interesting to me because I'm primarily Spanish, European Spanish, and I sometimes wonder if I have some Murano blood in me because I gravitate to this so much, and it could be possible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are the Muranos. Yeah, and it this is amazing how that works. That your dad could be right, huh, buddy? So he said you have Jewish blood as well. Mm-hmm. There you go. You could be descended from Muranos.
My whole family is Jewish because of
them. Uh
huh. Yeah. Dad's sister did marry a Jewish man, and a lot of that family now, and the kids are now.
Okay. Yeah, it's fascinating stuff, but it really is a sad history that we've got within our church of how we have treated Jews, and even throughout the Crusades, where we're getting right into the area of the Crusades now, for about 200 years. Now that Islam has been, you know, firmly taken over all of the Holy Land, all of North Africa, and into southern Spain. You want to talk about Spain again? You know, the Moors are Islamic Spaniards. So you got Islamic Spaniards, and you got Jewish Spaniards. You got all this mix, but at this point, they were pushing. The only thing that kept the Muslims out of Europe proper was the Byzantine Empire, that Eastern Roman Empire that lasted for another 1,000 years after Rome fell. That was the frontier that Islam couldn't quite break through. But it got pretty dicey there for a while. And finally, in 1095, the emperor at Constantinople cried for help out to the kings of Europe because he was about to get overrun. He'd lost a major battle and lost most of what's now Turkey. And so the first crusade was sent over. And this was the Pope's influence, the Bishop of Rome, which was able to galvanize and basically dictate to these kings of Europe to rally them, to get them to raise their armies and to send them over. And began a series of, it was about 9 crusades, major ones anyway, that lasted for about a 200-year period. But even these crusaders, these Christian crusaders who were coming to free the Holy Land from the infidel, from the Muslims, along the way would perform their own atrocities, especially in villages along the Rhine. They would completely massacre and wipe out Jewish villages as they were marching from Europe to Palestine. And so many pogroms and other atrocities are being perpetrated along the way by these Christian armies.
Were there other religions that did the same thing? Because I always hear about the Christians having this terrible, but like, were the Muslims ever forcing anybody to be Muslim, or the Buddhists, or the Hindus?
Sure, of course.
The same thing. They were like conquering land and saying you have to adopt our...
I've never heard of Buddhists doing that, but certainly Muslims did. At different times, different Muslim leaders would have different ways of dealing with their people, and some of them would subjugate and through force of the sword make people convert. Others would allow them more leniency to practice their own religions. It really depended on the ruler at the time. So there was no uniform way of dealing with, just as there wasn't in Christianity. You know, Christian rulers were more lenient and others were more strict. It just depended, you know. But generally speaking, both Christianity and Islam are very imperialistic in the way that they have dealt with the peoples that they, in other words, they have mixed church and state to the degree that conquering a people was the same both religiously and politically. Whereas in Judaism, you don't have that. Judaism doesn't proselytize at all. You know, they don't try to convert anybody. You can convert if you want to. You know, that's okay with them. But they don't try to convert anybody. And they subjugated peoples, but they didn't try to convert them to their religion. That's not part of their whole understanding of what they're about.
It sounds to me like the
people from the East, China, you know, Pacific Rim. Sounds to me like they got a break. It's a good thing they didn't have Jesus around.
They have their own history to deal with, and that's another story, but there is no place on the earth that's free of their atrocities and what's going on. Believe me. You know, it's just, that's not our story tonight. But of course, Far Eastern religions are very different. You know, they're as much philosophy as religion, and it's a whole different take. When you don't necessarily have they're not monotheistic, first of all. And they're not even theistic in the sense that they view God as actually being a person, a personality. Yeah, if it's not personified, if it's more of a force, if we are returning to God as the drop returns to the ocean, it creates a whole different type of mindset and attitude toward life and religion. And so it's very different than the monotheistic religions that we're discussing now. And looks like that's as far as we're going to get. Where we'll pick it up is is what happens to the Catholic Church, especially. Did you know that there were once as many as three popes at the same time?
And one of them was a woman.
No.
Yes. I'm going to prove it to you.
Okay, you do that next time. But we'll pick up there next week. So I guess I lied that tonight is not the last night of our introductory material. Oh, well. Guys, thank you. You are a wonderful group, very attentive. And we'll get into the rest of it next week.
Are we going to close in prayer?
Yeah, you guys want to close in prayer?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do that.